From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The war of words between President Trump and the three freshman House members known as the Squad lasted into this morning. Trump urged fellow Republicans to not show weakness and support an expected House vote to rebuke him. So far, most GOP officers have withheld comment or defended the tweets as not racist. We'll have where things stand between the president and the Squad. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Later this hour, New York Times science and medical writer Gina Collada shares the top 10 medical myths not borne out by research, from fish oil to peanut butter, testosterone supplements to knee surgery. What research says about ineffective treatments, supplements, and approaches. But first, day two of President Trump's and the foremost progressive freshman members of Congress's war of words. Over the weekend, the president tweeted that the four members of the Squad should go back to the countries they came from and fix their governments there before criticizing the U.S. Three of the four came from the U.S. One arrived as a 12-year-old refugee. The tweets have been blistered by Democrats and news media who've labeled them racist. All four women are non-white. Some Republicans have also criticized the president, but many more are silent or defending the tweets as having nothing to do with race. President Trump yesterday took questions in the Rose Garden regarding the tweet.
These are people that, in my opinion, hate our country. Now, you can say what you want, but get a list of all of the statements they've made. And all I'm saying that if they're not happy here, they can leave. They can leave. And you know what? I'm sure that there'll be many people that won't miss them.
But they're American citizens.
But they have to love, they have to love our country. They're congresspeople. And I never used any names.
Then following the president's impromptu news conference, the four Democratic House members at the center of the president's tweet held a joint news conference. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts kicked it off.
From our colleagues to our neighbors, we are grateful for your solidarity, your encouragement, and your support in the face of the most recent xenophobic, bigoted remarks from the occupant of our White House. I will always refer to him as the occupant, as he is only occupying space. He does not embody the grace, the empathy, the compassion, the integrity that that office requires and that the American people deserve. That being said, I encourage the American people and all of us in this room and beyond to not take the bait. This is a disruptive distraction from the issues of care, concern, and consequence to the American people that we were sent here with a decisive mandate from our constituents to work on.
Following her to the microphone, Minnesota Democratic Congresswoman Omar.
He's launching a blatantly racist attack on four duly elected members of the United States of House of Representatives, all of whom are women of color. This is the agenda of white nationalists. Whether it is happening in chat rooms or it's happening on national TV, and now it's reached the White House garden.
Comments from Congresswoman Omar of Minnesota. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California came out with this release yesterday. President Trump's tweets attacking four congresswomen have but one goal, to divide our country. They promote hate and fear, and they're absolutely unacceptable. Every time the president engages in such personal attacks, he only further lowers political debate in America and tarnishes our reputation as a country of openness and inclusion. I'm pleased that some of my Republican colleagues have joined in condemning these intolerable xenophobic pronouncements. And to the president, I would repeat something I've said before. This isn't how a president should act. Dianne Feinstein with her statement late yesterday from her office in response to the president's tweets and follow-up statements. Joining us with the very latest developments, congressional reporter for Politico, Sarah Ferris. Sarah, good to have you with us today. Can you give us a sense of the temperature on Capitol Hill today?
Well, it is. Things are pretty tense here still. Democrats are still responding with disbelief to the president's continued attacks against these four progressive freshmen. Of course, when the president is targeting members of Congress, this is an unusual situation, but it's particularly noteworthy given the racist language that he's using. So Democrats have been working on drafting a resolution to specifically condemn the president. This is a pretty extraordinary measure. And they were looking to get Republican support for this. They're hoping to have a bipartisan rebuke of the president. That vote will be tonight, although it doesn't seem like there will be many Republicans who do actually vote for it. So that's kind of where things stand right now. The tensions are still pretty high.
Sarah, do you get a sense that with most of the Republicans, they're just not going to be present for the vote, that that's how they'll deal with it, or that they will vote against the resolution?
Well, I think the strategy is still under discussion right now, but we do know that Republican leaders are encouraging members to vote against the resolution. And that's because they think they have a message. Republicans think that they can say Democrats are targeting the president. They're calling him a racist. That's not language that they're going to support and rally behind. Even if they don't believe what the president said about the freshman on Twitter was appropriate, they are not going to go out on a limb and call him a racist or call his language racist on this for the most part. So Republican leaders are hoping that they can reduce the number of their members who buck the party and vote with Democrats on this. My guess is that there's only going to be under 10, maybe 5 or 6 or so who've been willing to buck the president on these sorts of issues. So that's what we know so far. There could be members who vote present on the floor if they think this is going to be really a vote that could come back and hurt them later in 2020.
So, Sarah, does it seem, according to what you're saying, that how the Republicans vote is largely based on their perceptions of their district? Or do you have members of Congress, Justin Amash comes to mind, who recently left the party, but who've sort of individually taken stands against the president independent of their constituents?
I think there's a mix. I think we did see some pretty strong reactions from Republicans yesterday who this includes Republicans like Mike Turner. He's a Republican from Ohio. President Trump did definitively win his district in 2018 and 2016. We saw him come out and specifically say the language was racist. So this is a pretty good indication that Republicans are really angry about the way the president used this language to target the freshmen. Even if they're going to continue to unequivocally support him on policy, they think this was pretty bad politics at this point. But even Turner, who has already come out and said the language was racist, it's not clear if he's willing to go on the record for this kind of vote, which will draw backlash from Trump. It's one thing to put out a statement or a tweet if you're a Republican to say you disagree with the president's language. It's another thing to go on the record and have your name on that roll call vote for the president to be lashing out and individually targeting him on Twitter. And I think that's how a lot of members are looking at it. When they have to take this vote tonight.
Sarah Ferris of Politico with us, congressional reporter. I guess what I'm not clear on is why Republicans feel they can't be full-throated in criticism of what the president said and talking about its corrosive effect on politics and on the country generally, and the image that it presents for Republicans, without even having to get into the issue whether they think the labeling of it is racist or not is the issue. There's so much there apart from whether you debate the racist label that what's keeping them from coming out and denouncing the tone, the message, and the falseness of the tweets?
You're right. There could definitely be a broader cultural and ideological debate on whether Republicans are willing to go ahead and confront President Trump on this rhetoric that we've seen from him over 2 years. But that's just not the debate that Republican leaders on the Hill are ready to have. And so Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy has worked really hard to characterize this as a political battle against Democratic Socialists. He said specifically, this is not, he says, this is all politics. He doesn't think that the president's tweets are racist. Instead, he's trying to frame this in a way of this being a battle against socialists. He wants to keep this narrow. He doesn't want a chance for his own members to go take a broader stance on this. They don't want to really dissect the president's language on this because that's going to be painful for Republicans to have to deal with. So instead, make it simple, make it Republicans against socialism, and they can easily vote against this tonight. And they're hoping they don't face backlash. But of course, Democrats will be spending a lot of time and energy to make sure that their constituents back home do know that Republicans would not vote to call this language racist. They purposely chose a narrow resolution on the floor tonight. They could have gone even further, going more specific about all the ways that they believe Trump has conducted racist language or comments. And instead, they just chose these tweets, hoping to get Republican support.
Sarah, what is this technically called? Is it a rebuke? It's not full censuring, right?
No, it's not. And that was a very specific calculation by Democratic leaders. So this is a resolution of condemnation. It is still an extraordinary rebuke of the president. This is the first time they've directly condemned him. This is the first time they will directly condemn him on the floor in this way. So it's a very big vote for Democrats. There are some in the party, including those who had been targeted by the president. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar told us today that she does want to see the House go forward with the censure motion. These members have been explicitly targeted by the president. They want to see their caucus react even more strongly on the floor. There's a resolution that Congressman Steve Cohen of Tennessee has put out. He's been advocating for this behind the scenes to his colleagues. It would specifically call out the president's history of racist behavior, going back to the Charlottesville incident when he appeared to support some of the white nationalists at this rally. And it mentions a lot of other instances that are not mentioned in this more narrow, limited resolution that we'll see on the floor tonight.
And aside from it being a statement that goes in the record, there are no teeth to it, correct?
That's correct. This is something that is strictly symbolic. But it is something that a lot of Democrats have been pining for. They've been dealing with the president for more than 2 years, of course. And then this is 7 months into their majority, and they've seen the president continually go after their own members. These attacks, as I mentioned earlier, have really stepped things up as he uses explicitly racist language and continues to go after these members. I think there's been six or seven tweets alone today, and Democrats are just they're fed up with it. They want to take a stand here.
Well, and it's fair game for him to go after them. The question is the tone that he uses and the language and claiming that they're foreigners when they're Americans, all citizens, three of the four born here and the other were refugee. But it seems like this all gets commingled and so many Republicans are positioning this as, this is politics and the president is being called a racist when he's just criticizing political opponents. But it's not just straight criticism of political opponents.
That's right. And he has used the language that goes specifically after these members for what he sees as their backgrounds. Of course, he's insinuating that they are from other countries. As you said, three of the four are not. What's been interesting to watch is the House Democratic members who are from other countries, who were born in other places, really stand up for these members and say, look, we're the ones who weren't born here. These three members were born here. They are American citizens and have been since birth. So it's obviously been something that Democrats feel very strongly about, and they do think they need to force a stronger response versus just his usual criticism and attacks against the Democratic Party and its leaders.
Sarah, just before I let you go, are you familiar with any prior examples of this? Do we have any precedent for a president having a vote like this taken on his conduct?
I'm not aware of any against the president. The Democrats have been debating exactly how to use their censure, censure powers so far this year when Congressman Steve King of Iowa made some other comments that many saw as racist, and some Democrats wanted to specifically have a censure resolution. They actually ended up not going for that because there are some pretty strict rules about when exactly you're allowed or should be allowed to use this power to target a member, and that goes right up to the president. So Democrats have been hesitant to use a censure resolution on the floor so far, even since they took the majority.
Sarah Ferris, good to talk with you again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Congressional reporter from Politico, Sarah Ferris, with us on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about the ongoing controversy over how elite athletes at the collegiate level are not compensated beyond the room, board, little bit of living expense money that they typically get under NCAA rules. There are members of the California legislature who would like to change that and allow those athletes to be able to hire an agent and be able to be compensated for their image and for endorsements. We'll talk about that, pros and cons, in 1 minute. The National Collegiate Athletic Association, which governs major collegiate sports across the U.S., does not allow elite athletes to get agents before they graduate, and it doesn't allow them to sign endorsement deals. However, a bill making its way through the state legislature might change that. I say might because even if it passes, there are still some open questions as to how the state law might interact with the NCAA's own rules. Senate Bill 206 would allow college athletes to be able to make money off their name, image, or likeness. Now, proponents say that with colleges getting all those financial advantages of ticket sales and merchandising and images of athletes used to promote their intercollegiate athletics program, that it's high time for the athletes themselves to be able to get their cut. Joining us is California State Senator Nancy Skinner, Democrat who represents the East San Francisco Bay Area. You might recall she was with us very recently, just last week, talking about legislation on charter schools. Senator Skinner, good to have you back with us.
And welcome to be here, Larry.
Let's start with how this bill would work. So how would it free up athletes to hire agents or to make money from endorsements?
So, Larry, you mentioned elite athletes, but in fact, this bill would benefit each and every college athlete. And the reason is that the NC2A's very absurd and restrictive rules prevent any swimmer, for example, from teaching swimming lessons, or a softball player from being able to coach a little league. What those rules do is no matter what athlete it is, if they're in a college that's an NC2A college, they cannot monetize their athletic abilities in any way. And what my bill does would give student athletes the same rights that Olympic athletes have, which is the right to their own name, image, and likeness. But what that would do is, for example, allow for that good swimmer to be able to teach swimming lessons.
So you're saying at this point, if you've got, let's say, a swimmer at USC, that swimmer isn't able to go out and give swimming lessons for pay?
Absolutely. And if they did and the NC2A wanted to penalize them for it, they could kick them out and make them ineligible for participating in the college sport. And in fact, some of the most absurd ways NC2A has enforced that rule is on petty things like that. So while most of us think immediately about the superstars, for example, Zion Williamson, who, you know, just got after only 1 year and done, as they call it, this would benefit all college athletes. And it would allow, for example, those college athletes who might be entrepreneurial and do YouTube videos to be able to monetize their YouTube video. It would be able to let them sell a hat or a T-shirt. It's not just about agents.
All right. That hypothetical swimmer that we're talking about, could that swimmer work in another job unrelated
to swimming? I mean, they could work as security guard or barista or something like that. Okay. You're just saying they couldn't profit giving swim lessons?
You could go work at a fast food place, but look at the if a athlete, student athlete, serious about their classes, along with their training regimen and their classes, they have little to no time to do other jobs. They spend up to 40 hours a week or more in training. But let's go further than that. The other thing we may hear from opposition is, well, you know, college athletes get scholarships. Well, the vast majority don't, and especially women athletes. Very few get scholarships. So these restrictions are completely unfair.
And those restrictions apply even to non-scholarship players.
Correct. They apply to everyone.
We're talking with State Senator Nancy Skinner of the East San Francisco Bay Area, principal author of SB 206, also with us from the Association of Independent California Colleges and Universities, made up of 84 nonprofit institutions of higher education, the VP of Governmental Relations, Alex Graves. Thank you, Mr. Graves, for being with us. What can of worms does this open?
Yeah, thanks for having me. You know, that's a good question, and I think, you know, we appreciate the conversation around ways colleges and universities can better support student-athletes, but, you know, our position really comes from the concern that this places our member institutions in and the uncertainty it's going to create for the institutions, their programs, and their student-athletes. And you know, we do feel like our institutions are being offered up a bit as a canary in the coal mine on this issue and creating great uncertainty. You know, I would just say that in terms of student-athletes being able to, you know, work and earn compensation, there are a number of ways they can make money outside of athletics. I mean, as you alluded to, they are allowed to, you know, work on campus jobs. I would say my understanding is a little different around the ability to work camps and things like that. I think that they are allowed to work, you know, sports camps, so long as they're not. Those opportunities aren't exclusively made available to student-athletes, or they're being compensated in a manner, you know, disproportionate or dissimilar to their general student body counterparts. But, you know, I think compensation in this approach, untethered to education, creates some challenges. You know, there's certainly questions around how this might interact with sponsorships that universities have. For example, you know, if St. Mary's University, which is one of our members up in the Bay Area, has a sponsorship with Under Armour and a student athlete under this bill wants to sign an endorsement deal with Nike, does that jeopardize that funding stream that goes into the athletic department and serves all student athletes broadly across a number of programs and academic supports and what have you? We're certainly also concerned about, you know, the potential for undue influence with no guardrails around what we're talking about in terms of the compensation, the sources of compensation. And I think lastly, you know, we certainly feel that, you know, this is a step towards the professionalization of college athletics. And, you know, first and foremost, our institutions are working to educate students and student athletes to get them degrees. And, you know, we've had our feet held to the fire in the past over our graduation rates, and we've made tremendous progress, and the data bears that out over the last 10 to 12 years in improving those numbers.
You know, I had anticipated one of your first arguments, Alex Graves, was going to be, you know, these ideas may be all well and good, but for California to unilaterally put this into law sets all of these NCAA California institutions into direct conflict with the national organization. And the national organization could just say, we're not going to let California dictate to us, and could choose to exclude the California schools. Is that not a threat?
Oh, it absolutely is. It's certainly something that our institutions are concerned about. And, you know, there's a number of, you know, revenue funds that come back in through the NCAA to institutions at the Division I, but also the Division II and Division III level for things, you know, like academic supports, you know, replacement or not replacement scholarships, excuse me, graduate scholarships, you know, other wraparound student supports that, you know, supplement the athletics department budgets to serve and graduate all student athletes.
We're talking with Alex Graves, the Association of Independent California Colleges and Universities. Senator Skinner, are you concerned that if this passed in California, that the NCAA might choose to disaffiliate from California schools?
So first, let's be clear that there's no such restrictions as we've been describing on any other student, any other student. So a computer science student can develop their own app and market it. Any other student majoring in anything can become a professional. There's no restrictions. Now, the NC2A, interestingly, is not making the threat that they would make California colleges pull out of the NC2A. That's not their threat. And they can't really make that threat because there's good evidence that it would be a violation of antitrust law. And in fact, the NC2A has a history of losing multiple antitrust lawsuits. What they are now threatening is championships, that they would not allow California schools to participate in championships. But that is very similar to trying to exclude California schools, and there are many lawyers who have sent letters and who have testified at our different committee hearings indicating that that is a hollow threat because it would be a violation of antitrust law.
Senator, I also wanted to ask you about Alex Graves brought up the interesting point. If you've got a school that's got, you know, UCLA has this huge deal with Under Armour for athletic wear and shoes and the like, and if you have a top recruit comes in and Nike or Adidas or whomever signs him to a contract, then what happened? You know, what shoes can UCLA say? No, we're an Under Armour team. You've got to, you know, you can't be wearing the Adidas or Nike shoes. How would that work?
Well, first, there's no question that student athletics is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and our colleges are reaping a good amount of revenue from that industry. Now, I do not want to hurt colleges' revenues. But I appreciate that Alex has been upfront, that's the core concern of our colleges, that somehow if student athletes were able to market themselves or be able to somehow monetize their talent, that this would cut into the revenue of our colleges. But, you know, the pie is not that small. And certainly the student athlete cannot get the sponsorship for a team. The student athlete cannot do the media deal for the televising of the game or even the radio announcement of the game. Student athletes can't do any of that. That's exclusively the colleges. Plus, our bill has been, we wrote it to allow for the implementation to be delayed for 3 years so that during that time period we could internally establish some rules for California that would help address this concern that the colleges have so that their revenues would not be impeded. Now, certainly you see in both the NBA and the NFL that there are restrictions that players can only wear things sanctioned by the team when they're on the court, for example. And that's certainly an appropriate rule that could be applied in California for our college athletes.
I'm curious, Senator, just as an aside here, how did you get into this topic and get attracted to this as an area of legislation?
Well, I'm a Cal grad, UC Berkeley, Go Bears, and I attended school in the undergrad in the 70s, and Harry Edwards, the sociology
yes.
professor and also the athlete who helped organize the 68 boycott of the Olympics and wrote the book, The Revolt of the Black Athlete, I heard many lectures by him. And then over time, as a sports fan, especially basketball, every time I ever saw an interview, whether it was Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, LeBron James, they all raised this issue of the exploitation of student athletes. So my original attraction to this issue was from civil rights point of view, but as time went on and I thought more about it, this is not just going to benefit, it certainly will benefit black athletes, but it will not just benefit black athletes and elite athletes. Women athletes, for example, they have little to no opportunity to go pro. The only time they might be able to monetize their athletic prowess is during their college years.
All right. Let me share a listener comment from Jack in Zurich on our Air Talk page. While it sounds all cruel and bad to prohibit said swimmer from teaching swimming, we know that such a loophole will get exploited immediately by boosters to funnel money to athletes. Come to Football U. We'll give you room and board and a small stipend. But don't worry, we'll also get you a part-time wink, wink job teaching Pop Warner football. How does six figures for 2 hours a week sound? This was an issue, in fact. I think it was Wilt Chamberlain who actually wrote about this when he was at Kansas, that Wilt was paid for removing seaweed from the football stadium. It was some crazy, you know, made up job for him to earn money while he went to college. So how do you avoid that, Senator?
Well, as we know now, look at the scandals that are going on in colleges across the country, FBI investigations, where even with these NC2A rules, when you've got this level of money in athletics, there are people paying off athletes and exploiting. The benefit of rules like this is that we can set up rules within California that can help minimize that type of exploitation. Now, you know, unfortunately, no laws or no rules will absolutely eliminate such things. All we can do is do our best. But certainly, the situation that it is now has not avoided exploitation whatsoever.
Thank you, Senator Skinner. We appreciate it. Thank you. That's Senator Nancy Skinner of the East San Francisco Bay Area. The Democrat is principal author of SB 206, which would allow college and university athletes to be able to profit off of their likenesses, off of endorsement deals and the like. Alex Graves of the Association of Independent California Colleges and Universities, they're in opposition to the bill. Coming up, we talk about some of the biggest myths of medicine. They're debunked. New York Times science and medicine reporter Gina Collada will be with us. We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurtis. Just ahead, next hour on Air Talk, tweaks that have been made to the Southern California Shake Alert monitoring system. People didn't have the alert go off with the 7.1 Ridgecrest earthquake, and there are some people who thought that it should, even though the shaking didn't produce any damage in metropolitan Los Angeles. We'll talk about the now lowered threshold and the trade-offs that come with that. But first, some of the top medical myths. These are myths that continue to be perpetrated by many physicians who unknowingly think it's still sound advice, as well as being followed by patients who think they're taking important steps to protect their health. With us is New York Times science and medicine writer Gina Collada, who's written a piece on the top medical wisdom, 10 findings that contradict medical wisdom, and what's been debunked. Gina, good to have you with us again.
Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you again.
So we go from peanut allergies to testosterone supplementation, fish oil, so many different things here. What are these different myths and the debunking of them, the basis for this piece you wrote, specific research?
Yes, there was a guy named Vinay Prasad, and he and his colleagues decided they would look at three of the major medical journals, go back a few years, and say, what can we find where everybody believed it, and then there was a rigorous study that contradicted it? And about 10% of the things that they looked at were being contradicted. They looked at more than 3,000 studies and found there were nearly 400 routine practices were contradicted by studies in these leading journals. These 3,000 studies were published between 2003 and 2017 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, The Lancet, and the New England Journal of Medicine. They're like really the prestige journals. So more than 1 in 10, they said, was actually what they called a medical reversal, opposite of what doctors had been believing.
Well, and the aforementioned Dr. Vinay Prasad joining us on Air Talk, hematologist, oncologist, and associate professor of medicine at the University of Portland's Oregon Health and Science Program. Dr. Prasad, thank you very much for being with us. Why don't we start, first of all, with research on peanut allergies, which can be fatal in some cases, particularly for young people. What do we understand about early exposure to peanuts and its effect on whether someone develops a peanut allergy or not?
So first, thanks for having me, and I agree with everything Gina has said. I guess what I'd say about the peanut allergy question is it was longstanding dogma that if peanut allergies ran in the family or there was a high risk of other allergic symptoms or a child was at high risk of having a peanut allergy, the advice was the best thing you can do is to avoid exposing them early to the peanuts or to peanut powder or to peanut butter. But it turned out two really well-done studies that came out over the last decade in the New England Journal of Medicine, put that advice on its head. It actually looked like the opposite was true. If you had a family history of allergies and you wanted to reduce allergies in a newborn child, the best thing you could do was to expose them to peanuts and early and get that into their system. And that actually was shown to lower the rate of subsequent peanut allergies.
All right. Another one has to do with asthma attacks. It's another environmental exposure question. Should you keep your house as pristine, free of dust, insects, whatever, or should instead it be an environment that is kind of more like the outside world and exposing your kids? Gina Colotta, you want to comment on asthma and exposure?
I'd like Dr. Prasad to take that one. I'll take some of the others.
Okay, that sounds good. Dr. Prasad? Yeah.
I guess what I'd say there is we've had a couple of studies that kind of made us question things around asthma. The first thing I want to say is just to be really clear, we've got some pushback on this. We're not advocating for keeping a dirty house or keeping a dirty environment or having pests in the home. That's absolutely not what we're advocating. We want pest-free places to live in. I think that's a standard that everyone should have. That said, it is widespread belief that if you were able to say, for instance, if you had asthma and there happened to be mice in that dwelling, that you could get a very costly extermination company to come in and really try to get rid of all the mice there, and that was thought to lower the rate of asthma. And in a well-done randomized study, they found that that actually was not the case. And there's another example that we found from prior work, which was dust mite allergies. I think a lot of people wake up in the morning with asthma that might be worse in the morning, or they might have a runny nose, what we call allergic rhinitis. And the common teaching was you should zip up your bedding and impermeable bed covers to prevent those dust mite allergies from reaching your nose and mouth. And it turned out those impermeable bed covers are actually no better than a sham impermeable bed cover, a cover that actually allows the dust mites to move in and out. So I think what those studies teach you is maybe it doesn't answer the question of, you know, how should you keep your home? I think there are lots of reasons that go into that. It does suggest that if your goal is to reduce asthma, that maybe this small level exposure to some of these things might not account for that.
All right. We're talking with physician Dr. Vinay Prasad of the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, and Gina Colotta, New York Times science and medicine reporter. If you have questions about certain contradictory studies or questions about what is received medical wisdom that you think might be iffy, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Lucille writes on our page, what about the advice that moms often give to wait a half hour after eating before you go in the pool? Dr. Prasad, has that ever been objectively studied?
You know, it certainly didn't come out in our review of several thousand articles. We didn't catch that one. To my knowledge, I don't think that's been sort of rigorously studied. It would be interesting to look at that question. But perhaps it has. I don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah. Gene, have you ever heard anyone actually studying mom's advice on that?
I actually haven't, but some of these things are so old that they may have been studied years ago. Remember, Dr. Prasad and his group only looked at relatively recent big studies. Because I got a lot of people writing to me saying, well, why didn't you include this one? Why didn't you include that one? I said, I was reporting on a study that took three major journals and several years of research and just looked there. I mean, there's this whole universe of things that have been debunked. But you can't do them. You know, he was being specific about what he was looking for.
Well, and this again reminds all of us when we see in a magazine or newspaper online a particular study to not just swallow that whole and accept that as the final word. Because so often, you know, whether we're looking at types of diets or supplements, things like that, it takes multiple studies for a consensus to eventually evolve.
Well, actually, what's really interesting here, as Dr. Prasad pointed out, is that often this advice or these ideas were perfectly logical. And I can think of others that were not in his list that were done before that. Perfectly logical, made absolute sense. And what debunked them was not so much lots and lots of studies, but one really rigorous study. Where you took, usually they're called randomized controlled trials. One group gets whatever this advice is, the other group doesn't, and then you say, is there any difference? And it's interesting because you could say the logic is all there, it's got to work. And so many times, what's got to work doesn't.
Well, and a great example here, ginkgo biloba, the supplement made from the ginkgo tree. There was thought that this was protective against memory loss, against dementia, was a huge selling supplement. But what did the studies show, Gina?
Well, they showed it didn't do anything for you. But what's really interesting, and that was a study, a federal study, and it was one of the very few that really looked at a supplement like that. But what's interesting is if you look on the internet, it's still being advertised to promote your memory. And people are just preserve your memory. And people are, I think, so eager to find something to preserve their memory that they're often trying these things. And it, you know, sounds like it's a waste of money. And I have no idea whether it does anything else bad, but a waste of money at the very least.
We'll continue our conversation with New York Times writer Gina Collado, who covers science and medicine. Her recent piece, 10 Findings That Contradict Medical Wisdom, Doctors Take Note. And Dr. Vinay Prasad, whose work is the taking note here, from Oregon Health and Science University in Portland with us, too. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Next hour, we take a look at the shake alert for metropolitan Los Angeles. It's lowering the threshold for when the alert goes off to where it would pick up something like the earthquake in Ridgecrest, even though there was no damage from it in metropolitan L.A. But right now we talk about debunked medical myths with Dr. Vinay Prasad of Oregon Health and Science University in Portland and New York Times science and medicine writer Gina Collada. Let's talk about testosterone supplementation for older men. The question is, does that help men with their memories? Similar to what ginkgo biloba was espoused as doing. Dr. Prasad, what do we know about that?
So I guess we found in our little analysis two studies that were almost a decade apart, one in 2008, one in 2017, and both of them showed that testosterone treatment did not improve cognitive function in older men. And I just want to add one thing here. You know, I think it's very interesting how the testosterone industry and the supplementation industry has really taken off. About a couple decades ago, we had something similar, I think, with women and the use of hormone replacement therapy after menopause. And then that was also a sort of noted reversal in the early 2000s, where it appeared the routine use of that practice in women who had passed through menopause was associated with some serious harms. And I think that's something that Gina has covered in her prior work. And so here again, we're kind of feel as if we're reliving this with testosterone several decades later.
All right. We talked earlier about ginkgo biloba. Fish oil, what do we know about its ability to reduce risk of heart disease, Gina?
Well, that's one of the ones, once again, where it looked like everything was falling into place. I mean, people who eat a lot of fish seem to have less heart disease. There are omega-3 fatty acids in fatty fish, and that lowers levels of triglycerides. And if you have a lot of triglyceride, your risk for heart disease seems to be raised. And omega-3 fatty acids seem to reduce inflammation, and heart attacks seem to involve inflammation. All the logic was there. I mean, how much more sense could you make? But it turned out that when they did the randomized trial, the rigorous trial, didn't make any difference. They gave this to 12,500 people at risk for heart disease trouble, and it did not, they randomly gave them the fish oil or not. And those who took it were no better off than those who weren't. So, once again, you have all the logic falling into place and the rigorous study showing that the logic was not enough. It didn't work.
Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that the omega-3 fatty acids that come from fish, if you're eating a piece of fish, doesn't provide some protective benefit, right? We're talking about, because the testing was on the supplements.
Well, you don't know whether it does or doesn't. All you know is that people who eat fish seem to, as a population, have less heart disease. But people have been fooled a million times, not a million, but many times, by what looks like a dietary intervention that's going to make a difference in some disease, and then it really turns out not to. So I would say that at this point, it's not clear. It can't hurt you, probably, to eat a lot of fish, but to say it's going to protect you from heart disease, I don't know whether that's known or not. Dr. Prasad, do you have an opinion on that?
No, I think you put it well. I think the answer is we don't know the answer to that. And I think the point Gina's making that's really good is that when it comes to these dietary studies and we look to see, you know, do people who eat blueberries do better than those who don't? Do people who eat cashews do better than those who don't? Do people who eat more fatty fish like salmon do better than those who don't? We have to acknowledge that that's really kind of muddled and confounded by the types of people who have access to those foods over the types of people who don't have access, be that socioeconomics, other things that they do in their health, in their life for health, and that those other factors may be driving some of these relationships. So I think when it comes to teasing out what's the best and most healthy foods to eat, I think we have a long way to go. There's a lot of unanswered questions there.
All right.
That was sort of interesting. When people were saying that estrogen was going to protect against everything in creation after menopause, the National Women's Health Network pointed out, because they said every study, if you just look at populations, those who are taking estrogen, like everything you can think of, they have less of it, you know, less heart disease, better memories, whatever. And so therefore, it has to be that that's doing it, estrogen. And the National Women's Health Network person, Cindy Pearson, said they noticed, they found out by looking at studies, that anybody who takes a pill every day, even if it's a sugar pill, is healthier than the person who just doesn't bother. You're dealing, as Dr. Prasad said, with different populations. The people who say, I've got to eat fish all the time, they're probably also doing lots of other things to try to protect their heart.
Yeah, and so just because correlated doesn't mean that's what the cause of the benefit is. We're talking with Gina Kolata, New York Times science and medicine reporter. Her piece, 10 Findings That Contradict Medical Wisdom, Doctors Take Note. And with us, Dr. Vinay Prasad of Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. He's led multiple studies looking at reversals in research coming out on all kinds of different touted benefits. Step counters, calorie trackers, Gina, do they help you lose weight?
Well, that's one of my favorites, too, because they don't. And I actually was not surprised, because there's never been a good study that showed that exercise alone makes any difference in people's weight, probably because you have some sort of a drive to eat a certain number of calories. That's why you weigh what you do, and it's very consistent unless you're on a diet. And so if you actually walk your whatever, your 10,000 steps a day, whatever those extra calories are that you might not have burned if you'd sat at your desk instead, you're probably going to eat them. It doesn't take much. You just eat a few apples or something and it's healthy, and all of a sudden you've negated it all. So I wasn't surprised, but still, it sort of contradicts this idea, these step counters. I use this Garmin and it's always saying goal, goal, or move, because I'm sitting at my desk, and it's just hilarious because I think, right, goal, sure.
Hey, let me ask a quick question, Dr. Prasad. I don't know if you know the answer, but several listeners have asked about CoQ10, CoQ10 for high blood pressure? Have there been studies of that?
Let me just check. I guess I'll say off the top of my head, just from looking in our data set, I don't think we had seen a study of coenzyme Q10 for high blood pressure. But that would be something that certainly worth exploring.
All right. Thank you both very much for being with us. Gina Collada, New York Times. Dr. Vinay Prasad joining us from Oregon as well. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Second hour coming up. I'll tell you all about it momentarily. Listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell just closing a news conference where he's making comments about President Trump's tweets over the past couple days. We'll let you know what he had to say a little bit this hour right here on 89.3 KPCC. Also, later in this hour, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's because now there's genetic testing that can, of course, tell you whether you have a gene which indicates an increased likelihood of your having Alzheimer's as you age. The question is, what do you do with that information? And is it in the patient's best interest to have that genetic information or not? That's later this hour, right here on 89.3. And we'll also talk about Big Willie Robinson, the man who brought together different factions in street gangs, who brought people together across color lines in Los Angeles in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s through drag racing on the streets, as well as his own racetrack in Terminal Island. We'll talk about the legacy of Big Willie Robinson coming up later this hour. But right now, we start with the LA Shake Alert app. This was designed to help give advance warning to Angelenos when a major quake might prove to be a threat to life or to property. But the shake alert didn't activate in the wake of the 7.1 and 6.4 magnitude earthquakes that occurred near Ridgecrest just over a week ago. So now the shake alert is being modified to provide alerts at lower level earthquakes. With us, Robert DeGroot, staff scientist and coordinator for the Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning Project at the U.S. Geological Survey. Bob, good to have you with us again. We appreciate it. So I never expected, I signed up for the alert, I never expected I would get them for events like the Ridgecrest quake because there was no threat in metropolitan L.A. to property or to life. So why are you lowering the threshold for the alerts? It doesn't seem it was designed to alert to the Ridgecrest events.
So one thing that we've done is we've spoken with the City of Los Angeles, who actually manages the Shake Alert LA app, and also with Shake Alert Management, and also in Washington, D.C., to provide an opportunity not only to get a shake alert for potentially damaging shaking, which is what it was set out for both of the earthquakes but last week, but also for shaking that's potentially felt. So it's an opportunity for people to actually get the alerts and see what they're like and to potentially respond to them. So when you get the shake alert, we want people to take a protective action such as drop cover and hold on.
But that wasn't necessary in Metro LA for the Ridgecrest earthquake. And if you want knowledge about every, you know, quake of a given magnitude, sign up for the USGS alerts. I get those and it shows me every earthquake in the world of any size. Well, I don't understand why the shake alert needs to indicate for anything that's felt, even if there's no risk of damage or injury.
That's right. And that has been our position as well. And of course, we are very concerned and give our support to the folks in the Ridgecrest area who went through these events because it was very different for them than it was for the
Los
Angeles.
Yeah, if this was a Ridgecrest alert, you definitely want
that's
it going
right,
off.
That's right. But one thing that we're learning is that there is an interest in folks understanding how this works. The Shake Alert is a very important tool in the large toolbox of resources that we have to reduce earthquake risk, much like getting earthquake notifications. So we have to see what will happen. I mean, we really have to spend a lot of time talking about expectations. If we give people more information, then we need to be able to tell them what to expect.
Well, the problem is now by lowering the threshold, you're giving people the indication that they need to drop and cover in metropolitan LA for Ridgecrest-like events. But that's you know, for something like that, when you're that far from the epicenter, that's not necessary, is it?
It's a real issue. And I think that one thing that we have to take in consideration is that for that the levels of shaking that were experienced for a good portion of Los Angeles County where Shake Alert LA alerts is that for the 6.4, for example, my director was in La Crescenta. He didn't feel anything. And so getting a shake alert would have told him to take an action such as drop, cover, and hold on. So the whole issue is that we want to balance this whole thing of how many times are you willing to take action before the real shaking of significance arrives at your location. So in other words, how many times are you willing to take action for little or no shaking for that one time or two times that heavy shaking may arrive? And so that's a real consideration. We have social scientists on our team who are really looking into this to figure out ways to balance that out. And so the initial the starting point that we used with the city of LA was a way to strike that balance.
With the lower threshold, has it been decided what that threshold is now going to be going forward for Shake Alert?
Yeah, so the city of Los Angeles, so the USGS issues shake alerts at a given number all the time to everyone, and we rely on our partners, the 50 or so partners we have throughout the West Coast, to make some decisions about when and how to deliver those shake alerts. And the decision is based on a number of factors. For the city of LA's Shake Alert LA app, they were delivering at a potentially damaging shaking level, which is modified Mercalli intensity 4, and we're lowering it to modified Mercalli intensity 3, which is basically weak shaking. And in that particular case, as I said earlier, is that there may be instances where you do feel some shaking, some bouncing around. I was at a Ralph's Market in West Los Angeles near UCLA. I didn't know what was going on until 10 or 20 seconds into the event, and it was an earthquake. There may be cases where people will get a shake alert for no shaking that they feel. And so we have to manage those responses to those comments from folks.
Can you hazard a guess using the Mercalli scale 3 for actual ground shaking in metropolitan Los Angeles? Would the 6.4, the first of the two earthquakes, the major ones in Ridgecrest, would that have triggered a Mercalli 3? Do you expect?
Absolutely, yes. There would have been regions of Los Angeles County. I can't speak to downtown LA specifically for the 6.4, but definitely for the 7.1. There would have been regions within LA County that with the 6.4, there would have been MMI 3 shaking. Yes.
We're talking with Robert DeGroot. He's staff scientist and coordinator for the Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning Project at the U.S. Geological Survey, their Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena. I'd like to hear from you, your questions or your comments about Shake Alert and your input on what the threshold should be. To me, I thought it worked perfectly, and I'm a little disappointed that they're lowering the threshold to the Mercalli 3 degree of shaking because that implies you got to duck and cover at that degree of shaking. But I'd like to hear from you. Would you like it for everything that you potentially feel to get an alert? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. What do you feel like you need an alert for? What do you feel like you don't need an alert for? 866-893-5722 to let us know your thoughts about this. And the Shake Alert is designed for earthquakes that are at some distance, right, to give advance warning because of the difference in the speed of how the waves travel.
That's right. So even a fairly large earthquake really far away can generate those shaking intensities that would warrant the issuing of a shake alert. So things can happen. So we're not just talking about alerts going to people's cell phones or their iWatches or whatever, but it's also to automated systems like
elevators.
Trains. And so there are all of these actions that would be taken at a variety of thresholds depending on the application needed.
So the Mercalli 3, this weak shaking threshold, would not have to apply, say, to stopping trains.
The decision is made by the agency partner that we're working with. So LA Metro makes some decisions based on their infrastructure, based on their system, on what to do when a shake alert is basically received by their system, and they decide what to do.
Can they differentiate when it's received by their system between a Mercalli 3 and a Mercalli 5?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the things that we make available for delivery is basically an estimated shaking map, which tells them what the estimated shaking is in different locations. So they can use whatever software they've developed to make those decisions that humans are not necessarily involved in, those quick decisions. They can decide what to do based on where the shaking is the greatest.
And that all comes with the initial alert. That's not delayed.
That's right. That all is packaged, ready to go for delivery for all of our partners.
All right. David in Hollywood says, I want an alert for everything possible. I'm a contractor. I was working in a precarious position when the earthquake occurred. I would have removed myself if I would had seconds of advance notice. So, David, that's a very good example. Someone who was going to be in a precarious position. We know, for example, that authorities in Pahrump, Nevada say the only fatality, and this was from the 6.4, not from the 7.1 earthquake, but the only credited fatality in either of those quakes was a man who was working under his truck when it was jacked up in Pahrump, Nevada. And authorities there believe the earthquake knocked the vehicle off the jack and that killed him when he was under it. Have you heard about any other?
That's the only one that I've heard of.
So that's
sad.
Yeah. Yes. And he's there, you know, in Pahrump, quite a distance from from the earthquake, but in a vulnerable position.
Yes.
A very sad case. 866-893-KPECC. Chris in Hollywood says, I agree with Larry. The previous threshold was good. I only want an alert if something is going to cause damage, not just because I feel a little shaking. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Julian Sherman Oak says, I have two little ones. I need to grab them out of bed if there's an earthquake. My thing is, I don't want to wake them up if it's just a light quake. That's Julie in Sherman Oaks. Once again, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Yvonne says, I'm in Orange County. I don't know if we have any sort of alert for us, but it would be nice to have one. Bob, the shake alert, is that only designed for L.A. County?
The city of Los Angeles, when they developed Shake Alert L.A., made the conscious decision to only deliver shake alerts to people who are inside of Los Angeles County.
So L.A. City Initiative covers L.A. County.
Yes.
But it's really not going to tell – it's not going to be necessarily helpful for people in other counties.
That's right. And there are other products that are becoming available in the coming months that would potentially cover other parts of California.
All right. Let's see. We have other questions here. 866-893-KPECC. Number of listeners brought up the point they don't think it was well communicated what Shake Alert was designed to do, because it was described here you're going to get advance warning with larger earthquakes, but that the nuances of the threshold, the trigger, people weren't really clear on it. Do you have plans for ways of educating the public more on that?
Absolutely, yes. We're putting several initiatives into motion as we speak. As I mentioned earlier, we have a small army of social scientists who are working with us on the Shake Alert Project, which is fairly unusual for the USGS to do this kind of work. And they've really risen to the occasion. And we're looking at all aspects of education and training, including what to expect. And then also some of the scientific concepts related to this, I think, are critical as well. Telling the difference between magnitude and intensity, for example, of earthquakes,
which is one of the things that
came up during several conversations since the earthquakes.
Yeah, a lot of confusion on that because just to go over that again, the magnitude of the earthquake, we're talking the amount of energy released, where the earthquake occurs under the ground. That doesn't tell you how necessarily how much ground shaking
That's
there's going to be, the depth of the earthquake, what the subsurface, the composition of the soil is, what mountains are between you and where the quake, all these things affect the shaking.
Absolutely. That's correct. Yes.
So, and people, when they see magnitude, they think, oh, 7.1, all 7.1 earthquakes are going to be felt the same. And that's not true, even if you were at the, you know, very same location, place, because the depth could be different in that 7.1 magnitude earthquake. Wendy in Highland Park says, I don't think the threshold for notification should be lower, because then we're going to get alerts all the time. We're going to get blasé about it. And I'm sure that is a concern of the USGS.
That's right. And this is one of the pieces that we're looking at is this issue of over-alerting. So again, we've been trying to find that delicate balance between giving people the alerts that are going to be meaningful to help them reduce their risk, to protect themselves, but also not to alert them so often that they'll begin to sort of forget about the phone and not even look at it.
Astrogoth says, well, some people may want alerts for slight quakes, others only for larger ones. Would there be a way users could select for that?
That's a very good question, and that's something that we're exploring with both Shake Alert LA and also a project that's coming out of UC Berkeley called MyShake, and looking at the ability for users to filter what they get that comes through the system. And that's definitely an option. And in basically giving people a choice about what information they want and when.
Hey, Sean at UCLA has a really good point he wants to raise. Sean, go right ahead.
Yeah, hi, Larry. So I was just concerned because if we get notifications at a place like a stadium or a concert, for example, where we're not even necessarily going to feel shaking or in danger, you know, it might cause some kind of mass panic or something, and it sort of doesn't necessarily need to happen. You know, I was at the Hollywood Bowl when the 7.1 happened, and basically nobody noticed. But if we got the notification, I could imagine some potential big problems happening.
Yeah, and I can imagine, you know, Hollywood Bowl officials. Do we interrupt the orchestra mid-performance? You know, what? That's a great point you raised, Sean.
Yes, and I think it is a good point. And we're working directly with folks who actually manage these large venues, the people who manage security and safety, to look at these considerations, because they are the ones who are in control of that facility and will have to make decisions about how to handle the crowd when the event comes through all of these different devices.
Bob, thank you for coming in and talking about it. I really appreciate it. And it's yet another example of how it really is impossible to please everybody. And you're trying to serve multiple masters here. It's not necessarily
easy. That's right. But we're listening very carefully to what everybody's saying. And I think that's important. We hear everyone.
All right. Robert DeGroote, thank you for being with us.
Thank you again, Larry.
Staff scientist, coordinator for the Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning Project at the U.S. Geological Survey's Earthquake Science Center in Pasadena. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. We have so much more genetic information available to us through companies that take a swab and come back with what genetic precursors we might have to certain illnesses. But when it comes to Alzheimer's, would you rather know if you have a genetic predisposition with higher risk or not? Because it would probably affect your perception of things like, you know, losing your car keys or forgetting something. Is it better or not to know whether you've got a genetic predisposition? We'll talk about that in 1 minute. I sure hope you'll come and join us Friday for our very special broadcast, the 10 o'clock hour of Air Talk. We'll be live in our Crawford Family Forum right here at KPECC. We have a terrific panel to talk about the 50th anniversary of the moonwalk of Apollo 11. The 50th anniversary day of the walk is Saturday, so Friday we're doing a special hour of Air Talk with great guests, and we'd love to have you come join us in the Crawford Family Forum. It's free, of course. We do ask you reserve your place by visiting kpecc.org/in-person. I hope that I get to see you Friday morning, 10 o'clock, right here at 89.3 KPECC. Well, the rise of direct-to-consumer genetic testing has given us a closer look at our DNA than ever before. Family heritage, of course, is one of the things we can find out quite a bit about, but it also provides access to health markers, genetic markers that could indicate increasing risk of certain type of illnesses, including Alzheimer's. But the question is it better for us to know or not know if we have a genetic predisposition toward Alzheimer's? Because, of course, you've got many people who have that gene marker who are never going to get Alzheimer's. Other people who don't have it who will get Alzheimer's. So it tells you about comparative risk, but it is by no means definitive. So does it cause more anxiety, more harm than good, to know whether you do or don't have the genetic marker? With us is Robert C. Green, medical geneticist and professor at Harvard Medical School, also associate physician at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, where he directs the Genomes to People genomic research program. Dr. Green, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you think it is best for people to have this information, that maybe there are early interventions or lifestyle changes they could make that would help them having this genetic information?
I don't know that there are interventions that will help them. I think that remains to be seen. But I do think that for people who want the information, and that's a very important caveat, for people who want the information, they should be able to receive it in a responsible manner.
Is there more that the genetic testing companies could or should do to help people manage emotional responses to receiving this information?
I think they're doing a pretty good job. At least the best of the direct-to-consumer companies are doing a pretty good job. They very clearly tell you, as you did in your intro, that this is not a deterministic marker. That doesn't mean you're definitely going to get Alzheimer's disease. They tell you it's a risk marker, which it is. And then they give you a special checkbox, and you have to make an affirmative decision even within the direct-to-consumer company offering to elect that particular result. And they do that with all of the sensitive results. And there are still people who kind of click through and don't really pay attention and maybe get that information when they didn't really want it. And there are definitely people who can become upset by that. But what our research, which is quite separate from the direct-to-consumer companies and was not funded by the direct-to-consumer companies, what our research showed was that if people are aware of what they're asking for and they kind of get emotionally prepared for it and they actually handle it quite well. Now, I don't want to be cavalier. I'm sure there's someone out there who's learned that they had the marker for APOE, for increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. They became and may still be even upset. But most people who elect to learn this do very well with the information.
And I also wonder if it's something where if you know you have a family history of this, it's easier to prepare. One of the first examples of the genetic testing that I can recall was, is it Huntington's disease, which killed Woody Guthrie, I believe, which is inherited. And so people in a family with it can take a test to determine whether they are going to have this fatal disease or not. So you can emotionally prepare. You already know if you're in that family, there is some degree of elevated risk. Or families where there's a history of breast cancer, testing for the BRCA gene that can be associated with certain types of breast cancer. But, you know, if you're not aware of that family history, I wonder if that then makes it more difficult when you get the word that you've got this predisposition.
Well, I think you're exactly right. We found in our research that people with family history, whatever the condition was, were more concerned that they were at risk, and I think appropriately so, and they were often more eager to get themselves genetically tested. And so it can cut both ways, because you can find out that you either do have a genetic risk, and you already mentioned some of the cases where you can do something about it, and we'll circle back to that, but you can also find out you don't have that particular genetic marker, and you could be falsely reassured. So instead of Huntington's disease, which is completely untreatable, and Alzheimer's disease, which we don't have a treatment yet, let's go to the examples that you just raised about different kinds of hereditary cancer and different kinds of, let's say, hereditary heart disease. These are conditions where you definitely can benefit, sometimes in a life-saving way, from knowing early. And it turns out that people, even who have rich family histories, are frightened to get tested or don't know that they should be getting tested. Primary care doctors are not offering this. People are not kind of, when they are offered, people are hesitant to do it. So my message would be this is not something to be afraid of. Genetic testing for more and more diseases is going to reveal paths to treatment and prevention. And this is something we should be thoughtfully embracing, we should be encouraging, and we should be excited about.
We're talking with Dr. Robert C. Green, medical geneticist, professor at Harvard Medical School. Also with us from DePaul University in Chicago, professor of bioethics and health sciences, Craig Klugman. Professor, good to have you with us. What are your concerns about these genetic tests and people learning that they've got some sort of a genetic marker indicative of higher risk?
So my concerns have to do with the way that people react and the way that this has gone about is that there's no context when people get these results. So they're checking a box, and if you look at the 23andMe terms of use, it talks about that the information they provide you should be used for entertainment purposes only. Most people don't get that far in reading the document. And you're probably home alone, maybe you're with a loved one, when you get these results. And so now you don't necessarily know how to react to this. Nobody knows how they'll react to this information and what can be done about it. And, you know, I think I agree with Dr. Green that if there is a disease that we have some treatment, we know how to prevent or at least to put off coming down with the disease for a while, then it makes sense to do testing. But for something like Alzheimer's, where there is very little we can do other than to adopt a healthy lifestyle, which you should be doing anyway, I think that this can cause more harm than good, more stress than good. People might have a false belief in these tests. They're not 100% accurate. The new blood test that's being shopped around now is 88% accurate. So that means 12% of the time you're going to have a false positive or false negative. And what kind of decisions might you make based on this without understanding that these are not definitive answers to whether or not you will get Alzheimer's? So maybe you will choose to get to not have children. Maybe you will choose to put less or more money away in your retirement fund. And then what happens if this information gets out, if there's a break in privacy? So perhaps your insurance company finds out about it and they say, oh, we're not going to give you long-term care insurance because you're going to need more than most people. Or we're not going to write you a life insurance policy because you're likely to die sooner than most people. So there are problems that can come around, that can come out from having this sort of information with that you're getting at home without the context. And there's a question about the accuracy of the information and whether one should act upon it. Is it just causing undue stress and fear, or is it really going to help people change their lives?
Is it possible that this, though, would help in clinical trials, because as different approaches to Alzheimer's are tried, you would be able to clearly identify the individuals at greater risk. Therefore, you'd get results that are more usable. Wouldn't this be helpful?
Well, I mean, the test that 23andMe is using tests for the APOE gene, and this is a high risk factor in Alzheimer's, but it's not a definitive risk factor. So there are other genes that are involved in whether one gets Alzheimer's or not. And so, you know, the test that is definitive is not there. What we can say is you statistically have a higher likelihood, but that doesn't really say if you're going to get it or not. So I'm not sure that it would have more use in testing. Plus, when you're doing a clinical trial, there is informed consent. There is an institutional review board that makes sure that the patient is being, well, the subject is being protected, that they are given appropriate information, and that they have support. It is reviewed and supervised. When you take this at home, you're clicking a box, and you don't have that sort of support system or oversight built in.
The bottom line, would you test for whether you've got the genetic marker for Alzheimer's?
So I do not have a family history of Alzheimer's. And so for me, I could have some mutation in my DNA, but for me, no. I would not want to do the test. I would not want to know because I wouldn't want it to affect the choices that I make in my life.
Dr. Green, what about for yourself? Would you want to know?
Oh, yes. I've done. I've not only done all of the direct-to-consumer tests, but I've also had myself whole genome sequenced a couple of times. And at our hospital, at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, we have started one of the country's first preventive genomics clinics, which will offer people a menu of different types of predictive genetic testing, which will be contextualized around the rest of their health care. But may I respond to
yes.
Sir Klugman's points? Because I agree with some and take issue with others. He raised 5 points, harm, accuracy, privacy, discrimination, and benefit. Let me just quickly take them one by one. Professor Klugman mentions harm as if there is evidence for harm. And in fact, the evidence suggests the opposite. We've performed 4 randomized clinical trials with a flagship paper published in New England Journal of Medicine that demonstrated no distress, anxiety, or depression as a result of people volunteering to get ApoE testing and learning their results.
Okay.
Number 2, accuracy. These SNP chips are actually 99.9% accurate in calling the genotypes, and they are CAP and CLIA certified at the best of places. Number 3, privacy. It certainly is always potential for privacy breaches, but your privacy is invaded right now much more by what you type into a search engine online than by any precedent in the invasion of genetic information that's happened in the history of genetics. Number 4 is discrimination. There's federal law that protects you from being discriminated against on a genetic basis by your employer and your healthcare company. He's right. There's no law that protects yet against long-term care or life insurance, but we should be working on regulations for that.
All right.
And in terms of benefit, this is a nuanced one. I totally agree with him that the benefit is higher when this stuff is contextualized within the practice of medicine, and I think that's where it should go. But for the moment, medicine isn't there. Medicine isn't meeting the bar. The only place some people who want this information can get it are consumer-facing companies, and the best of them are using very good FDA-approved communication channels to get the information through to them. So I'm not trying to defend direct-to-consumer genetic care, genetic testing companies. I do think they have some problems and some inadequacies.
All right.
But I don't think they have created as much of a problem as people feared when they came out.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both. That's Dr. Robert C. Green, Harvard Medical School professor and medical geneticist, and professor of bioethics and health sciences at Chicago's DePaul University, Craig Klugman, joining us as well. Coming up, we'll talk about a man who left a lasting impression on Los Angeles, bringing people together across racial and income lines in the wake of the Watts riots, Big Willie Robinson. He's the focus of LA Times reporting and a New Times podcast. We'll talk with the man behind both right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdy's. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day is going well. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. Conversation with the author of The Nickel Boys, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Colson Whitehead. I was having to see an interview with him on CBS this morning. Terrific conversationalist. His book is set in the early 1960s and based on the true story of a notorious Florida reform school. You probably remember a few years ago the tragic digs that they did on the grounds there, finding the bodies of boys who had died at the school, the evidence that boys were beaten and abused at that facility. So Colson Whitehead has written a novel that uses that real-life event as the point of departure in conversation on Fresh Air, coming up next here on KPCC. But right now, we turn our attention to a man who had a huge impact on Los Angeles, Big Willie Robinson, who arrived in L.A. and shortly after the Los Angeles riots, determined that there was a good way of bringing Angelenos together across racial and ethnic and income barriers and through the power of L.A.'s car culture. Big Willie Robinson set up drag races on local streets, ultimately ended up with his own racetrack on Terminal Island, and Los Angeles Times reporter Daniel Miller has put together a series in the Times as well as a multi-part podcast to tell Big Willie's story. But first, let's hear from Big Willie as he describes in episode 2 of the podcast about the starting of his street races just a year after the Watts riots.
Cops came in incognito looking like they were street racers too. So they walk up to the white racers and say, "Hey, aren't you scared being down here? The Watts riots was just a year ago. And now you're in Watts after midnight. Aren't you afraid?" And they said, "No, because it's all about racing."
And racing was what brought people together. Daniel, thank you for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're telling Big Willie's story. I first heard about him when I was a kid. My uncle, who drag raced and raced typically at local tracks like Lyons and Orange County and Irwindale, went out to one of Big Willie's races. I think it was Exposition Boulevard, closed off. And the next morning, he's telling me it was incredible. He had everybody organized and they're keeping everybody back and emphasizing safety and order. And it was, you know, black people, white people, Latinos, everybody coming together. It was quite a scene to be at one of Big Willie's events.
That's right. And I've heard a lot of stories like that. I would say this: Willie wanted to do two things. One, he wanted to make street racing safer. And two, he wanted to use it to bring people together. And it actually worked. And in the wake of the Watts riots, the powers that be in Los Angeles were desperate for change. And in Big Willie, they found somebody who they could work with to reach out to South LA. And so he actually worked with the LAPD to stage street races.
Well, and let's talk about how he becomes such a larger than life figure. Obviously, he's a huge personality and he's a sharp organizer. He really understood how to get people to work on his behalf and to pull together. But how did he cross over to the authority figures in the city?
Well, I think he was a natural organizer and he had a charisma. I mean, it was just innate. He's 6'6", muscle bound titan. And when he spoke, people listened, and the cops started showing up incognito to his street races, just as we heard in that clip, and they saw how he was able to keep the peace and bring people together. So a lieutenant in the 77th Precinct named Frank Beeson reached out to Big Willie, and before long, they organized a meeting, and that's when Big Willie met Tom Bradley. This is probably around 1967. And Tom Bradley, of course, would go on to become the city's first black mayor. But in Bradley, Willie found a benefactor early on, and that was key to his success.
We have a photo of Big Willie on the Air Talk page at kpcc.org. And you can see that, muscles rippling and, big guy and a big personality to go with it. In your Los Angeles Times piece, you interviewed a number of the men who worked closely with him, and the affection that they have for him and the esteem in which they hold him, years after his death, it's quite strong.
It's remarkable the love that people feel for Big Willie, friends and family alike. I mean, he was a father figure to many. And look, the world of street racing is a rough and tumble world. But Big Willie really cared for people, and he really believed in his message. And I think these days it can feel a little Pollyanna, the idea that, cars can unite people and help solve a city's problems. But, I interviewed countless people who saw it work. It's really true.
I'd love to hear from Air Talk listeners who were there, who knew Big Willie, who maybe raced in one of his street races that he organized with the approval, hard to believe, of law enforcement. Close the streets, line the streets with people, have safety monitors, people out organizing. I mean, this was not just like impromptu. This was all thought out and organized and backed by the police. Later, he ended up with his own track on Terminal Island where he ran races. So if you were someone who went to those races, raced in any of those competitions, knew Big Willie, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. And Daniel, one of the big things that he did was able to work across the lines of LA street gangs. How did he do that?
So a big part of Willie's success in getting gangs to come together was his racetrack, Brotherhood Raceway Park on Terminal Island, which opened in 1975. And I think his innovation was simply to say, we welcome all. We're not going to check you for guns. We're not going to check your cars. We trust you to come in peace to this track. And I think what he did with that message was create a neutral zone. There was this idea that out at Willie's track, you set aside your beefs and you got down to business. The business there, of course, was racing cars. So this track was open on and off for 2 decades, and it was just a wild place. I mean, you'd have to invent this place, right? It doesn't seem real.
Well, you could bring any car. The other thing that I recall is anything was fair game to race.
That's right. His motto was run what you brung, which meant anybody could get a race and any car was welcome.
Station wagons, you know, the cars look better suited for demolition derbies than drag racing.
Yeah. And I think, but, you know, there's something important to that. It allowed anybody to participate, whether you were a millionaire, a movie star, and he had some of those there, or in a gang, or if you didn't have much money. I mean, there were shopping cart races. There were foot races. Anybody could participate in the fun.
All right. We're talking with Los Angeles Times Enterprise business reporter Daniel Miller and quite the enterprise that Big Willie Robinson put together after he arrived in Los Angeles from New Orleans. We'll talk about what led him as a young man to make his way to L.A., as so many did as a part of the Great Migration, and how he found his place as an organizer for street racing, drag racing at a track to bring together all the diverse elements of Los Angeles. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. The podcast that accompanies the pieces on Big Willie is titled Larger Than Life. We'll be back in 1 minute on Air Talk. We're talking about Big Willie Robinson, the focus of a new LA Times podcast, but there's other big podcast news. LAist Studios, just launched by Southern California Public Radio. The announcement on that going out yesterday. And LAist Studios is going to develop multiple podcasts, which you tell the Los Angeles story, but for the world. These are a wide range of different topics, not necessarily the kinds of things that you would hear on radio, but sometimes there will be affinity between what you hear in LAist Studio podcasts and what you hear on KPECC. So you'll be getting additional word about all kinds of new audio programs coming out of LAist Studios, the podcasts from Southern California Public Radio. Right now, our focus on Big Willie Robinson, Larger Than Life, the man, as well as the title of the LA Times series and the podcast by our guest, Daniel Miller. Again, if you're someone who knew Big Willie, who raced or was a spectator at any of the events that he organized on the street, are at the track. We're at 866-893-KPECC. A couple of listeners want to bring up, you know, the dangers involved, particularly in street racing. I'd mentioned how Big Willie made safety a real priority, but now, of course, street racing is spontaneous, not organized, and deaths in street racing happen all the time.
That's a fair point. It's something that we do address in our podcast. I would say this: Big Willie's goal was to make street racing safer, and ultimately he wanted a racetrack where he could get this off city streets. And the Brotherhood of Street Racers, Big Willie's group, still exists and to this day is advocating for a safer way to race, and I think would desperately love to have a racetrack again. Of course, your listeners are right, and the LA Times has also detailed the deadly toll of street racing in Los Angeles County. dozens and dozens of deaths over the years. And it's something that we do acknowledge, and it's something that I'm certainly aware of.
Well, and it's unfortunate that all the tracks that used to exist are largely gone. Real estate costs, you know, Orange County International Raceway gone, developed, you know, with industrial property on the site. Lions Drag Strip gone. Irwindale is always touch and go. The new Irwindale, the old one, is long gone. It's, you know, very, very difficult to keep these tracks going.
I think that's fair. Irwindale is really the last track standing. On Thursday nights, they do an event where you basically can run what you brung for a nominal fee and a safety check. You can get out on the drag strip, but that's really the only local option. So many tracks have closed, of course, including Big Willie's track.
Yeah, I loved when I would go watch my uncle drag race at the end of the night, and the station wagons, the sedans would come out, and, you know, the middle-aged suburban dads would race each other. Those were as entertaining as seeing, you know, the highly tuned, very fast cars that the regular drivers brought to the track every week.
Yeah, I saw a bit of that myself at Irwindale. I saw an older gentleman drag racing his Tesla Model S.
I love it.
I brought my old Datsun 240Z out to the track, so they welcome all.
All right. 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Now, you mentioned that at the Brotherhood Raceway, stars would come out, and Big Willie kind of became very popular in Hollywood circles, to the point where he was in films.
That's right. This is a fascinating turn in Willie's life. He was a bit part actor for a time. He had a bit role in WUSA, a movie alongside Paul Newman, also in a street racing movie called Tulane Blacktop that starred James Taylor.
I remember that.
So these are some iconic early 1970s films. Via Tulane Blacktop, Big Willie met a producer named Gary Kurtz. Gary Kurtz went on to produce Star Wars. So Willie has some wild claims about Star Wars. Willie claimed that he was first offered the role of Darth Vader, but because he was on a nationwide tour drag racing in the 70s, he wasn't there to receive the call, so missed out on the part. Now, that claim is something we explore in depth in an episode that actually was released today about Willie's Hollywood ties. It's a wild story. There are others. He has some claimed ties to the Fast and Furious franchise. You know, when we say Big Willie is larger than life, we mean it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, regardless of how direct it is, the Fast and the Furious is today's logical extension of the world which Big Willie was creating.
Yes, that's fair. In speaking to some members of the Brotherhood of Street Racers, they see some uncanny connections between the film series and their group. You know, some pointed out that some of the scenes in the film and some of the films were shot near or possibly even at Big Willie's old raceway. And of course, Big Willie preached this message of unity. And anybody who's seen the Fast and Furious films knows that's a film series about a brotherhood of sorts, right?
Let's talk with Gino in Pasadena. I understand you used to race at the Brotherhood Raceway.
I did. Hi, Larry. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, this was back probably mid-90s to late 90s. Street racing was huge here in Southern California, especially where I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, Pasadena area. When Big Willie opened up, he actually opened up at a really, really great time for us here. At that time, gangs started infiltrating the street racing scene. A lot of these street races were being held in industrial areas, industrial streets, very dark, out in the Ontario Inland Empire, some in the 310 area code. And unfortunately, yeah, there were instances where gang members were shooting at the street racers. I believe there were some deaths that were covered on local news stations. But great memories. I mean, just like the gentleman that you have on was stating that, you would run into white people, black people, Hispanics, Asians, all the board, all the colors. And it was just a great time. No fighting, no alcohol, nothing like that.
Well, and that speaks to Willie's ability to have everybody feel included. And then here they relate to each other very directly. Maureen in Burbank says in the late 60s, I was 17 or 18, went to Big Willie's. One woman had a food truck with Mexican food. She was like the vanguard of street racing. Everyone was so respectful. I still have my street racing card, Maureen says. That's Maureen in Burbank. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts. Appreciate it. And Daniel, thank you for talking with us about the multi-part series. I know you must feel like you're part of Big Willie's family after all this time interviewing people who knew him and spending time getting to know him posthumously. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Once again, the series Larger Than Life tells the story of L.A.'s own Big Willie Robinson, who arrived from New Orleans to make a huge impact on L.A. racing, the podcast from the L.A. Times. Have a great afternoon.